Welcome, William Evans here, and you are listening to another Living World Conversation. Our guest today is Barbara Dills, and this is the second in a sequence of conversations about the Columbia River people and the salmon run they tended for over 14,000 years. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you, Will. Happy to be here again.
Thank you for coming back. Please pick up where we left off at the end of our August conversation. You were starting to tell us about David Sohappy, a Yakima elder and fisherman who you became acquainted with.
Yes, this was during my second stint of living in Oregon in the early 1980s. And I became aware of the fishing rights struggles, which were definitely in the news all the time at that time along the Columbia River. And so I started to research, and those fishing rights struggles were of Native people struggling against a lot of regulation and legal intervention and so forth. I dove in and started researching it, and this is something we talked about in the earlier conversation, but basically I had spent a lot of time with the Plains people in South Dakota earlier, about 10 years before, and when I moved to Oregon and started living along the river in the town of Hood River, I just became aware of how parallel the history of fishing rights on the Columbia was to the struggles of Lakota people to retain and also to revive their relationship to the buffalo. That was a connection for me that was very meaningful. And so I started to get involved in the fishing rights struggles along that part of the river.
Right.
And that's when I learned about David Sohappy and his history, and also eventually had the opportunity to visit with him at his home along the river.
And for a time, he and the Yakima people had a summer fishing camp and lived on the Columbia.
They did. His family, their camp was up in the higher ground, up much more toward what is now the Yakima Reservation. But he described for me how he, and has for others, how he, as a little boy, they would go to the river in April when the salmon started to run, and they would harvest fish all summer and dry them all summer for their winter food, and then return away from the river to their other home around October to winter.
And they would fillet these fish and split them and hang them on wooden racks in the sun.
Correct. Yeah. They solar dried their fish, and it's very delicious if you ever have it.
I have had it because I went up Denali on dried salmon from the villages I took care of in Alaska.
So you know how tasty it is.
Oh, and how nutritious.
Yes.
And full of life force.
Yeah.
So what happened when their place on the Columbia, their essential summer fishing village, was no more?
Well, in his family's case, where their, you know, traditional family site was for summer, became part of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, personally for his family. But people probably know that that's been a disaster for the ecology and for the people who live in that area, both Native and non-Native. But in any case, David then, you know, most of his adulthood, or a lot of his adulthood, lived on the Yakima Reservation. He was an enrolled member of the Yakima Nation, but eventually decided he really felt the pull to live along the Columbia again. And partly that was to defend their fishing rights that were being eroded drastically. And so one of the major cases that ended up, you know, not granting their fishing rights, but reserving their fishing rights from the treaties of 1855. One of the most historic and important decisions was called the Bologna Decision in July of 1969, and David Sohappy was the lead plaintiff in that case, representing a variety of other members of his Yakima tribe. And very important thing about that case is that it was a landmark case in that Judge Bologna ended up siding with the Indians in asserting their treaty-granted right to fish at all their usual and accustomed sites.
Right.
So David Sohappy was an activist in the sense of putting his name behind that effort and really committing himself to protecting as much as he could their old way of life along the river.
You were interacting and visiting with these people for a few years.
Absolutely.
During this long, protracted, heavy and difficult process.
Yes. I mean, I didn't move there until 1980, but yes, the process had been going on to try to keep the defense of their rights for some time. But then everything kind of came to a head again in the early 1980s.
And go ahead and give us a little detail about what the outcome of that was for David Sohappy.
Yeah, so there were two issues really that the government was trying to, I guess, use to get the Indians off the river. And one of them was he got charged with this along with a group of other native fishermen. One of them was that they were entrapped by I think it was Washington state authorities in that case, because the river is the dividing line between Washington and Oregon. So the north side of the river where David's a little home on the river was, and the south side in Oregon, the river is what defines that border between those states. So depending upon which side of the river you're on, you could be facing a different regulatory challenge. But in any case, David and a few other people were basically entrapped to sell fish to undercover agents in what the government called out-of-season sales. What ended up happening after the Bologna decision is that certain seasons were defined as being open to Indian fisheries for ceremonial purposes that were longer than the fishing seasons they were allowed for the sale of fish. So they were arrested, charged, and eventually convicted of selling fish out of season. But the second issue was had to do with what are called the in-lieu sites. There were 20 dams eventually built along the Columbia for hydroelectric power. And originally, the original dams that were built had no accommodation to allow the fish to travel upriver. But even the government realized that wasn't good because the canneries that were upriver were then denied the fish, just like the native people were. So eventually they rejiggered some of those dams and added fish ladders. And so a certain number of fish make it over those dams every year to their spawning grounds, which is their instinct. When I was doing my research back in 1987, it was estimated then that 15 to 20% of all the salmon trying to navigate past the dams would die as they went over. So even the dams, once they had fish ladders, had a really negative impact on the salmon runs. When the government inundated the villages that were traditionally along the river, including a homestead that belonged to David Sohappy's grandmother, they promised the Indians, this is one of those great tales of the dominant culture retreating on its promises to native people. But anyway, they promised that they would rebuild those homes along the river And so they defined, I think it was 37 different sites that they called in-lieu sites. In lieu of where you lived before, we will rebuild your home. But then World War II intervened, and all the funding that had been set aside for that purpose somehow just kind of evaporated and was never reinstated. So over the years, certain Columbia River fishing families kind of moved on to those sites, partly to protect them and make sure that they stayed in lieu sites and weren't just swallowed up by some developer or even somebody for sports or whatever. So David was one of the, David and his family were one of the families that decided to move on to those in lieu sites. And now back to the 1980s, the government decided that it was time to evict the Indians from those sites. They changed their tune and said, well, the in-lieu sites are only for fishing. They're only for temporary use. And so families that had actually built dwellings, including David Sohappy's family, they were served with eviction notices. And then, you know, a whole other set of legal challenges followed that.
And I want to bring in a thread of the nutritional potency of salmon, because ultimately that determined David Sohappy's fate, because he realized how powerful that food was for him, how it helped him stay in balance, and what happened to him when he was denied that.
Right. So he was diabetic, and it was actually one of the key motivations when he moved his family from Yakima down to the river, because he wanted access to the river as much of the year as possible so that he could return to eating a natural, you know, ancestral diet. And that's not only the fish, but also the wild game and the roots and in the fall, the berries. And he had a really nice garden, too. So in any case, he was able to manage his diabetes on his traditional diet. And when I met him, I think it was 1984, met at his house, I mean, he was sinewy and strong. And probably by that time, I don't know, he was probably in his 70s. And I mean, he just was the pillar of health. And he would go out in his little dinghy onto the river and fish when it was allowed, and then dry that fish. And that was the core of their diet. Once he was charged and incarcerated for the fishing out of season charges, he was in the penitentiary system where the food was, you know, white bread, mashed potatoes, sugar, and his health went downhill very, very quickly. And eventually, those charges were overturned through appeal. But he never really survived the change in his diet, and he passed away shortly after being released from prison.
Yeah. This is KDNK, and you're listening to Barbara Dills explain the relationship of the indigenous people with the Columbia River Salmon Run.
Well, I thought I might just share one quote from David Sohappy about the in-lieu sites.
Sure.
Because it's something that he said to me in person and made a huge impact on me. And he said, "The government says we can only have temporary dwellings on the in-lieu sites." Temporary? What do they mean by temporary? I don't know about you, but I am only temporary on this earth.
Yes, and it's ironic that you read that, because the other dimension of this is that this salmon run kept people really healthy, strong, and vigorous for 14,000 years, you say?
I think you know more about that long-term history than I do.
Well,
definitely.
We just to have a little documentation, we know the Kennewick man was close to 10,000 years old. So there was this ability to live through heavy processes, difficult processes. And how did these people do that? What can you tell the listeners about how they carry so much heaviness and loss?
Yeah, I mean, I can only speculate kind of from the outside, but what I feel like I learned both living, you know, with my Lakota family in South Dakota and then saw mirrored in the river people that I got close to along the Columbia River was this sense always that kind of alongside all the loss and heaviness and the cultural degradation that has been, you know, wrought on them, there is also a lot of joy and humor and celebration and ceremony that embraces both. And I think, you know, as a young person, I was only 21 when I first made it to Rosebud. I think it was very, I wouldn't have articulated it this way at the time, but just to have that example of people making it through unbelievable tragedy and still being able to be loving and kind and have great senses of humor was a teaching that I certainly would not have gotten just from my New England family in the same way.
And the other value that is part of it is this enormous generosity, even through times of scarcity.
Exactly. And that's almost an expression, too, of lightness, you know. And a story I can tell from Rosebud, and then it's echoed in these first food ceremonies along the Columbia, is that there was very little food in the American and Indian Movement camp where I lived, that especially that first summer, but back and forth as I went back and forth to the reservation, surviving a lot of the time on what they call commodity foods that people who were enrolled at Rosebud could go and get once a month, things like, you know, watery, stringy canned chicken. And we used to joke that we should do the commodity cookbook, you know, because we had to figure out ways to fix this food for the guys. It wasn't easy. And especially for me coming to the reservation as a vegetarian, it was a big challenge. But in any case, you know, there wasn't a lot of food. So every once in a while, either a cow would be donated to the Crow Dogs, which is where I lived, or they would go up and find one trespassing on their land and they would just take it. And so I actually was put in the position within the first probably week or 10 days of arriving there of being asked to help butcher, which was quite
the vegetarian butcher.
The vegetarian butcher, which was, yeah, talk about eye-opening and life-changing. So that we butchered that whole cow and you know, they didn't have adequate refrigeration to refrigerate a whole cow or a freezer or anything at that time. And all of a sudden, you know, people started just driving up in old beater cars and stuff with empty cardboard boxes. I don't know how they knew. We call it the moccasin telegraph, you know. But somehow people knew that there was a cow that had been gotten. And all that meat was given away within 24 hours to people in the community who needed it. And there we were back to not having much to eat, but nobody viewed it that way. It was all the right way to do it, you know.
Right. And you see this generosity flowing into the seven-generation decision-making process.
Yeah, it's all of it's interwoven. You know, you can't really separate any of it. But I think people are probably familiar with that phrase, you know, the seven generations. And we even have, you know, a company that makes dish soap and toilet paper that is, you know, called seventh generation. But, you know, that's a very, whether it's articulated exactly that way or not, it's just a very, almost in my experience, universal value in Native culture here on our continent. And basically, the ethos is, you know, any major decision a community or even a leader of a community makes, even the head of a family or a family unit, always takes into account, what's the impact of this decision going to be on generations, seven generations ahead? And right now, we are in the young people are the seventh generation since a lot of the treaties were made on the plains, at least. And so that's also kind of notable. But community I worked with in Rosebud, you know, even at a sort of institutional level, with all kinds of community programs and so forth, that concept is talked about all the time when they are making decisions about various programs and implementation policies and things that sound a little bureaucratic but aren't in that context because of that consideration.
Right. And it's extraordinarily beautiful to me to see generosity come out of people who have been essentially targets of genocide, and certainly nutritional deprivation intentionally, but they hold this memory of an oral history of abundance, which they continue to hold in a way that they manage what they have to get through the lean years as well as the years of plenty, and keep alive this whole alternative worldview compared to what I was educated in.
Exactly. And there's a recent example of that when the government shutdown happened and the flow of funds to SNAP program ended, temporarily anyway, which cut a lot of people in Rosebud off from being able to afford groceries. The tribe now has the largest tribally owned buffalo herd or indigenous owned buffalo herd in the world. And they just upped their butchering and gave away the bison meat to the community to try to offset the lack that came from the stopping of the SNAP program.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Well, I've shared with you that I had a personal experience of doing something inappropriate, and my indigenous friends eventually saying, "Oh, Will did that." But they said it to me in a strikingly neutral and loving way, and yet it was a powerful reprimand.
That's a really interesting story, yeah.
And those experiences were a learning for me that opened my eyes to the aliveness that I'm part of and I have a responsibility to.
I think I had so many times of either being shown right in front of my face the better way to do something, or of being, you know, reprimanded lovingly, especially in those first few years in South Dakota. I think that's a very common experience.
Well, an aliveness wasn't part of my education. It didn't acknowledge or honor the gift that was given to me. And in essence, when I've been reprimanded by indigenous people, I'm being re-educated to see the responsibility I have to live with my gifts.
Absolutely. Yeah. And to also take others into consideration, whether those others are human, animal, plant, whatever, but to always be cognizant of the impact of one's actions.
and my future generations, mm-hmm. my progeny.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I call my experience in Rosebud, I came from a fancy college in the East where I had been on the dean's list and, you know, so forth and so on, always the first one to answer in class, and thought I was pretty smart. And then I landed in Rosebud and figured out all that I did not know about life. And I call it my de-education. It was really a re-education in a whole different way of looking at the world, but I also had to be de-educated.
Can you say a little more about any of those experiences?
Well, I didn't, they weren't necessarily easily. I mean, there's so many, some of them very funny, but yeah, I mean, I think even just coming and thinking I could stay a vegetarian in a community that depended so heavily on whatever protein they could get, even that, you know, and then within days to realize I was going to starve if I didn't eat the meat out of the watery soup that I was served. Just watery broth and potatoes were not going to sustain me. So it just happened on every level, every day.
So the Columbia River was, and I'm intentionally using was in the past tense, because it isn't what it used to be. It was a vast nutrient network of living tributaries of the Northwest. And my sense is the indigenous people haven't lost that vision and that possibility, but it's an enormous loss.
And an irreversible one, really. I mean, there was talk at one time about trying to close the Dalles Dam and bring Celilo Falls back, which stirs up all kinds of feelings for the river people. But it's, I mean, there's no feasibility of ever seeing that river restored to its natural beauty.
No, and probably no one will ever camp at the Tri-Cities at the Hanford Nuclear Plant. But people were camped there. The Kennewick Man was there nearly 10,000 years ago. And David So Happy's family had a camp there. But it's not anymore. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you, Will. A pleasure again.
You've been listening to Barbara Dills explain the relationship of the indigenous people with the Columbia River Salmon Run. This is KDNK. Thank you for listening.